Okay. So that's the history. How do we bring this all together? So I think the way to bring it all together was discovered by Maratz Pius, Rabbi Hirsch Pius, in the 19th century, who really I left him out earlier. Right? Rabbi Hirsch Pius, I think, my teacher, Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, used to talk about how some people analyze sugyot and some people create sugyot. Like the whole, you know, before them, nobody thought this was a topic. So Maratz Pius, I think, really at least recreated the sugya of Jewish political theory. Right, before that, there was the Rambam who wrote Hilchos Malachim, but Hilchos Malachim is obviously a political theory treatise. And then you have, it basically lies in abeyance with a few other writers, the Ran and the Ravenel. The Aruch HaShulchan writes another halacha book, but political theory, pretty much Maratz Chayes is what there is. And Maratz Chayes comes along and he says, at the core of the matter, I don't know where our teacher Maimonides derived that he may jail or beat with sticks for the sake of his honor, but he may not declare money ownerless if he did so, it is theft. If he has authority over the lives of the people, should he not have such authority, kal vachomer, over their money? Right, so the Rambam seems to have this odd notion, right, that he can kill people, but he can't take their money. Secondly, he says, the law of one who rebels against the kingdom is not mentioned in the Torah at all. So where does that come from? We know it comes from Yehoshua. But how can that be? How could the Torah not mention the death penalty for rebellion if it's really there? So he says, therefore, something original seems true to me, that all the rules of the monarchy are just an agreement between the king and the people. And that's the fun, right? So the fundamental thesis Maratz Chayes says is that the reason you have this pendulum is not because they disagree about the meaning of the Torah, it's because the Torah is a constitution and not a code. It's not telling you exactly how the political monarchy can run. You can have an absolutist system, or you can have a democratic, you can have a democratic constitutional monarchy, and the Torah is not interested. The reason the Torah gives the king no specific powers is because the Torah is okay with the king having no specific powers. The Torah is okay with the king having all executive powers. Not judicial, because there still has to be a Sanhedrin, and right, and not sacerdotal, because the kohen is hereditary, and he's not automatically charismatic, but he's okay with the king having all executive power, knowing full well that executive power is always potentially tyrannical, and that's a choice that the Jewish people are entitled to make. What they can't do is say that the king is really above the law, and the king has to be bound by Torah. But they're allowed, right? You're allowed in the social contract, you're allowed to give up your rights. So long as you give up your rights within the framework of the law. Now I have strong biases in this regard. I'm much happier if we take the model that is in the Rambam than if we take the model that's in Yeshua, per se. What I want to argue is that, in fact, that thesis is I think, far and away the best explanation of the divergence among the sources. And it's not the best explanation of any specific source, but it's the best divergence of the change over time in the sources. This is one of the areas where the Torah is deliberately ambiguous, as is the Constitution. Right? There's a reason that certain powers are left implied. There are certain explicit restrictions, and then they have implicit powers, and then you get to decide whether those implicit powers are taken as everything is reserved to the people, and how expansively you take things like the elastic clause. I will add that that Rabbi Chayes' position was adopted by Rabbi Shaul Yisraeli, who was a great religious Zionist posek in the 20th century. Without quoting Rabbi Chayes, apparently without being aware of him. He developed the identical thesis. Now he developed it in a context which I find troubling, I have to admit. He developed it in an attempt to justify Ariel Sharon's raid, which ended up in many civilian deaths in the draining town of Kiba. So along the way, he develops the notion of theoretically absolute human autonomy, which includes the right to suicide, then he says, but that's only true for non-Jews and not for Jews, because non-Jews have complete autonomy, but Jews are bound to God, and therefore don't have the right to give up their lives. And so there are all sorts of aspects of the argument that I find troubling, both in his premises and his conclusions. Nonetheless, right, as a matter of record, he ends up in exactly the same place as Rabbi Chaya, which to me certainly strengthens the claim that this is at least a plausible position in interpretation of the sources. But I'm happy to credit Rabbi Chaya, who I think is the first person who developed the thesis. And so summing up together, what I'll argue is Chacham Fa'ur sets out a very, very broad theoretical claim. I wanted to test aspects of that claim, specifically the notion that the true sovereign is the law, and that the Torah is deliberately set up to an, not multiple interpretations in the theoretical sense, but deliberately set up to enable multiple frameworks for communal living to be legitimate. And my claim is that thesis can be, that if we test that thesis in the context of the laws of kingship, which is about as explicit a statement of political theory as we have, it turns out to be true, that there is a fundamental commitment to the king being subject to the law. But we should be aware that commitment is tenuous. It's very, very strong in the Rambam, but it's much more tenuous in Tosfot. And you know, we could be facile and say that Tosfot lived in, you know, at the just as the divine right of kings is gaining a foothold, whereas the Rambam is fleeing the Almohad persecution. Right? We could do things like that. I prefer not to be quite so facile. But I think that, you know, that there is a certain extent to which you might think historical contingency is there, and if you adapt Maharaz Chayes, it's perfectly reasonable, since the Torah was intended to be adaptable to multiple political theories, so long as you establish these kinds of values. And part of the responsibility of having a constitution is that you can get it wrong, and that's what Shmuel says. Right, with the that's a way of reading Shmuel, where what Shmuel says is, look, even if you obey the Torah perfectly, but it's not a guarantee, because the system has enough bend in it that terrible things can happen that will still be within the limits of the Constitution. So that's the overarching theory. I myself am very partial to at least the Maimonidean scheme, and the most radical thing, sometimes when I give the shir without the philosophic baggage at the outset, so I call it, right, how much power should the Messianic king have? And I think that if you take, there's some people, this takes one more step, right, some people argue, well, you know what, they made one compact with Yeshua, and that's binding forever, and then they made another compact with David, and that's binding forever. It seems to me a very hard position to sustain, because the people walked out on Rechavim. And the fascinating thing is that really nowhere in Tanakh that I know of does anybody yell at Israel for not heeding the Davidic monarchy. Right, that's not right. It's divinely ordained that your Yeravim will get 10 tribes, and there's no right. There are no Nevi'im getting up and saying, right, you guys in Eretz Israel, you've got to listen to a Davidic king. So. So I think that my suggestion is that there's no reason that in a Messianic era that really the first thing that should happen should be a constitutional convention. And we might end up with modern England. Right? Which Som Tosim Alecha Melech Shetayim Maso Alecha means that we have guards with funny hats parading in front of the palace at regular intervals. And the king gets to maintain a palace which is also a tourist attraction. And to read the opening statement of the Sanhedrin, and that's it. And there's nothing in Torah which requires anything more than that. By the same token, Torah doesn't require that either. We could have a system with a very strong hereditary executive, and Torah doesn't prevent you from that. Yes, Andy.
Essentially, it's up to the people. They want to place a king over you, yourself, and the nations. comes to restrictions, you know, it's very kind of like social contact oriented, right? You accept or some, as you said, there's some restrictions put on here. I guess that's it for, you know, biblically accepting Yeshua, that's also more of a compact, right? So where does it, where is the, you know, in terms of Yemei HaMashiach, I mean, while we reflect on the splendor, apparently, of David Melech and Yadu, but where is it biblically sourced that indeed it has to be, you know, a monarchy that that's part of the establishment?
So that there are psukim in Yeshaya, right? That seems to right. That suggests, you know, there are psukim that there are psukim in Shmuel where God seems in Dirayamim where God seems to establish a permanent covenant with David. That right, you have Lo Yasur Shevet Mihuda, right? So there are all sorts of psukim that become reasonably interpreted as guaranteeing a permanent Davidic monarchy. But I think we guarantee a monarchy.
It's really odd in the sense that, you know, really it seems a concession.
Well, so I don't know. You know, the Rambam is both ways, right? It says, because you can treat it as an imperative. Most Rishonim read it as an imperative, right? That you must place a king over you. Just when you place the king, you have to have these restrictions. Right? The Ravenel, right, as I said, even though this is really atypical of his theory generally, Ravenel says that it's only, it's if you do it, then you have to do it this way. But most Rishonim read it as, right, read Som Tassim because it's doubled, right? As an imperative, right? Usually when you have what's called the infinite something or other? Infinitive something other? I forget what it's called. Somebody must know this, no? Nobody's taking biblical exegesis lately. What is the infinitive absolute? Right? Som Tassim. Right? So most people treat that, right? Why do you need the redundancy is designed to create an imperative. And if it's really just a reshut, why not just say Tassim Alechem Melech? I would be happy to go with you and say, I'll be honest with you that it's a minority position in the halachic tradition to say that it's not only Ravenel. I forget, I think Rabbi Yitzchak Blau has a couple other people who seem to tend that way, but I just have to be honest, you know, I can't claim that it's a majority position, and I can't claim that it's so textually compelling that I'm willing to stake myself on the minority position.
So how do the majority then that see it as an absolute obligation square that with what God says to Shmuel, which is, they're rejecting me. The whole literary cast of that quote is, this is rotten, but hey, we're all stuck with it. It sounds like what you said earlier, that God is saying, well, I'm bound by the law. I didn't insist that they do this, but they have the right to do this. They're invoking that right, and I have to obey, so you have to obey. But it really would be better if they didn't.
So I think that's reasonable, but you can also, so I say, a lot of people try to say it's because it's a king like all the nations. I really find it uncompelling. But I think is that they say we want a king to judge us. That's not so uncompelling. That right, that they want a monarch who doesn't have separation of powers, and God's very much opposed to him, right, to a monarch who isn't subject to the Sanhedrin. And
this judging is one
of Malchut Beit David. Yes, that's a whole question whether the king. So we have to point out there's king judging as part of the. Right, you can be a judge which expresses your obedience to the law. Right, and you can be a judge whose word is the law. So I think right, it's a great question, but I think that the Rambam would argue that Malchei David is in his ideal system, judge, but they have that their judging is an expression of their subservience. Right, that they become part of the legal system; they are subject to the Sanhedrin. Right, they have to follow precedent. And that's all the images of David HaMelech, right? Sitting with his Rebbe, sitting in the Sanhedrin and being outvoted, right? All of, right? Those are all his images, as opposed to the image of judging that the people are talking about, which is that you have the king's justice, which is yes. So we should point out, right? I should say that what I'm doing here, in many ways, is in opposition to what is a very popular current position, which is the position of the Drashot Haran. The Drashot Haran celebrates. That the justice of the king is free from halacha and entirely independent, and halacha doesn't have to work because the king's justice can practically play the role. So I am as strongly as I can arguing that that should not be seen as a normative position in Jewish tradition, that is more a tragedy than an ideal. where the judicial system fails, and we resort to the king's fiat. But I'm acknowledging that at least in the Gush universe, and I am right now a minority, because the Drush and Ran has been discovered, and people and liberated people from the notion that halacha had to work. I would like to re-imprison us. Yes.
I was just wondering if, you know, Rabbi Pius was saying, oh well, you know, so where did the Torah give that authority that he could kill people that are married to Malchut? So he ends up saying, well, people sort of granted that, and that was a deal that they made, and so on. But where's the authority for that? In other words, I mean, you can be mochel your money. Sometimes we talk about, but I can't just go up to a friend and say, listen, I've decided to be mochel. If you want to kill me, you can kill me. You know, they kill me, and it's all.
So as I said, Rabbi Israeli believes that non-Jews can.
Right, no, I heard that. In
right, so...
But I'm saying, within Rabbi Chai's here, saying, with a Jew, whatever, right?
He believes that, too. He believes that, you know, that essentially, right, essentially, that that for legitimate purposes, you're entitled to...
not restricted to a king, necessarily? That was just one example? It's just
so he probably has to follow the Machlokas, Tosus, and the Rambam. So the other way, the Rambam holds that it's forbidden to sacrifice your life for mitzvot or not yehareg kol yavor, but Tosfot holds that it's not required, but it's optional. And if you take the position of Tosfot that you're allowed to sacrifice your life for any right, for any purpose you deem worthwhile, so why can't you sacrifice why can't you be willing to sacrifice your life because you think that will create a better political system? And I think that I think that, again, you have to reverse the position whether you're holding like Ram or Tosfot like that. I think Rabbi Chayes and Rabbi Israeli take the position that really, fundamentally, I guess you can make a much stronger claim, not teaching this summer, but we tend to have this powerful rhetoric that that life is a supreme value in Judaism, but it's obviously not true. Life is a value, but there are values that are higher. And then the question is, are there values that you're entitled to give your life to? And I think that... as a different context, I would say is that there's an essay by Rabbi Zevin, which really has had enormous cultural impact, in which he argues that human beings belong to God, and therefore, right, the prohibition of suicide is because you are God's property and you can't do that. That essay was responding to, or is it responded? That essay. Rabbi Israeli's essay is a response to Rabbi Zevin's essay, and I think that there's no question that Rabbi Israeli just devastates Rabbi Zevin. That Rabbi Zevin's essay is astoundingly effective literarily and utterly uncompelling textually. So I think that that's just, it happens that there are certain things that in America just, that there's just essays that, like Jacob Katz, right, has the famous thing that we've before Rashi, Yisrael afal pi shechata Yisraelu, meant the Jewish people, even when they sin, remain the Jewish people. Rashi came up with this idea that it means individual Jews, even once they sin, remain Jews, and therefore, and he did it in a context which we wouldn't cheer nowadays. Right? He did it to oppose the position that if somebody apostatized, that their wives could be free without a get. Because they're still right, because they haven't ceased to being Jewish, and then once Rashi says that, then it just sweeps the world, and nobody ever suggests again, occasional outcroppings in Erie, that converting out of Judaism has any halachic impact. But it's this rhetorical flourish that just sweeps the world. So Zevin has this rhetorical flourish, and everyone somehow learns it when they're young. But on the merits, I think that Israeli's essay, much as I say that on the merits, I have deep, deep trouble with Rabbi Israeli's essay, but if you ask me as a matter of textual interpretation, it's a massacre. Rabbi Israeli has cool things, but Rabbi Israeli is it's just a really, really compelling counter case. So I don't think so. Rabbi Chayes was not aware of either of these positions. But I think that fundamentally, if you adopt Tosfos' position against the Rambam, and Tosfos has, so Dr. Soloveitchik has a famous essay in which he points out that the Tosfists go further than saying that you're allowed to sacrifice your life. They even permit active suicide a series of cases, and he has a famous essay in which he seems to suggest that they came to that position because of the moral pressure of being unable to tell people who were really, really from and sacrificing their life that they had done, you know, your son who just slit his throat rather than bow to an idol, right? Really, he's writhing in Gehenna forever because he committed suicide. But again, you can always say that, you know, because that itself is really powerful pressure, spiritually, not politically, spiritually, that people who you know are really from and do things that you otherwise would think are wrong, that puts pressure on you. But that's on the active suicide level. But on the level of being willing, you know, of being willing to sacrifice yourself, that I think there's a lot of evidence of people sacrificing themselves, and we see them as heroic. You know, there are more tragic cases that come nowadays. The book I still have to get a hold of in Israel, which was written as a memorial for a soldier who threw himself on a grenade to save his company. Now, nobody halachically holds that you're obligated to throw yourself on a grenade to save somebody else. But there were Rishonim who held that it's usur. Right? So this is a book, justifying that and saying that the majority position is that you're allowed to sacrifice yourself, and instinctively we tend to react to that as heroic. So I don't think that it's so hard to...
But what Rabbi Chaius is doing is not just talking about individuals doing that, he's talking about that the collective has somehow forfeited right.
But the collective is to get it. At the time that people were asking for a king, again, what was happening societally? Was this, we were under attack by the police team, or what was...
Yeah,
So basically people wanted a king, and they were willing to limit their liberties, and perhaps even you could argue, if their life on the line, if they thought the collective would be better off with a king that had the authority to say, listen, you get in the army or you're going to get it. I mean, because as a whole, the collective and your family, you know, will be better off, and your relatives, if there's order and a strong leader. So
we're still having this argument now about arming police.
It's right. So in terms of it being, it's not something that's an abstract sort of like spiritual sacrifice my life or not. I mean, it has tangible, you know, quality of life, societal implications, you know.
Right, but you might argue that you have that people have no right to assume any risk to life.
And yet that we were greater risk, perhaps, if we don't risk.
So you want to argue that maybe they're even just making a pragmatic choice.
You need to give the king the authority to say, okay, this guy's going to get it because we all need to pitch in fight the police team or something.
Well, it's now, right? We have to give the police the authority to shoot to kill because we take the chance that we will more likely be the person saved than the person killed. And you might say, now, what, right? That's a simple example. Or you might say, right, we allow the king to draft people, so that's already in the Torah, but because even though the individual person, you would say, should refuse because it's pikuach nefesh, what am I doing going to war?
Okay, so right, so then you want to bring current times, right, that quote-unquote a thin blue line, yes, we give additional authority, what have you, but even that's still checked by law. I'm just trying to very simplify this back to the actual time to understand. I could imagine that, you know, the society wanted a stronger leader which had additional executive authorities, right, for their greater benefit, right?
Yeah.
It seems the Torah wouldn't be allowed for this, right, circumstances arose. You know, it's a concession, I guess.
The question that we always say is, even though there are things that the Torah allows, but nonetheless things are really bad idea. That's what Shmuel says.
Yeah.
Right? We allow this, but you should know it's a really, really bad idea. Because the Torah gives you room to make...
Or we allow it, isn't it? It's a fortunate concession to the times, you know, because if you guys were frumer or something, you know, the police team wouldn't have any money. Who knows, right? But
in the end, Shmuel says it's a really bad idea. Right, so I think that's you know, the more expansive notion. The Torah is a constitution, and part of it is that it gives you the autonomy to make mistakes. So I would, you know, so I'm on that one. I think it's a mistake. Okay, last question, Alan.
But does it give you the autonomy to make a mistake that would overthrow the constitution itself?
No, that's what I think. That's, I think, would go with the best of the worst thing. You cannot, right? You don't have the authority to appoint a king who is above the law. And I think that when Malchei Yisrael are above the law, that has to be clear, that is a breakdown of the system, and not a... you might, you know, if you want to argue historically, you might argue that something happened in the Mishnah, that distinction got left out, But I don't need to make the argument historically. The Gemara puts it back. And so I tend to think that the Mishnah is a rhetorical flourish, and the Gemara is pshat, and that really, ultimately, everyone understands that that the king has to write a Sefer Torah and he has to be bound by it. I think that's, I think the Rambam's pshat. But I think that Maariv Chayes is even better than pshat, because the Rambam's only talking about the compact the way we have it, and that we could renegotiate the compact. And you and I will be on the libertarian side, and we renegotiate. All right, thank you very much.